Well, how's everybody doing? Awesome. That was incredible, incredible worship. Thank you guys for leading us through that. As Norton said earlier, my name is Jason Malik. I'm one of the pastors here on staff. And normally I find myself upstairs taking care of kids. And I don't mean taking care of. I'm the family minister. We are really passionate about leading people, including our children, into a growing relationship with Jesus Christ. So I have the unique privilege and honor to be able to celebrate with children, both in worship and in teaching, every single week. So those of you who have kids know that, at least from my opinion, they're in really, really great hands with incredible volunteers and leaders. Last week, or actually 2 weeks ago, we finished up a series, or Stephen finished up a three-week series that was titled The Good Life. And Stephen was really asking the question, what really is the good life? Is it something that's possible? Is it something that's achievable? Is it something that we can actually accomplish here on earth? Because darn, life sure seems difficult from time to time, doesn't it? And the good life, how in the world do you pursue that? It was a fantastic series. If you haven't listened to it, I encourage you to do that online. Well, I wanted to kind of take that question and essentially turn it upside down. Because, as I mentioned, oftentimes, life isn't so good. In fact, sometimes it can be downright difficult. And so before everybody ran too far down the road pursuing the, quote, good life, I wanted to examine, what does it look like for you and for me when life gets bad? When life isn't going the way that we want or hasn't gone the way that we want? And part of what motivated this, I have to be honest, is in our community, I've heard lots and lots of stories of people who are going through some pretty adverse times. There are folks who are dealing with some relational stress that oftentimes seems kind of insurmountable. Many of us these days, with the economy the way that it is, are dealing with job uncertainty or maybe even joblessness, looking for jobs. Lots of folks, obviously, that goes with that are dealing with financial uncertainties and stresses. And so as I kind of listened to the stories that were being told, I figured, let's take a step back and let's just examine that. What does life look like when it's not going so bad? Or maybe even more importantly, how do we respond when adversity sets in? Now, we call this the dark room. And I have to be honest, maybe I'm dating myself because dark rooms are somewhat dated, aren't they? So for those of you who don't know dark, does anybody not know what a dark room is? I'll give you a little brief deal. I don't know this kind of physics or science behind it, but dark rooms are where you develop that like acetone tape that's now called film, that's like in archives. They're like in places where we don't go anymore. A dark room is where you develop that and turn it into pictures. Those of you from the digital age are wondering, what is a dark room? The point is, dark rooms are dark, pitch black. They're claustrophobic, and oftentimes they're incredibly stinky. Anybody been there? Been in a dark room? There's chemicals. There's all kinds of nastiness. Well, life oftentimes is claustrophobic, isn't it? Life can oftentimes seem kind of dark. Life can be stinky from time to time. And so we wanted to take just a couple of minutes and talk about that together. And hopefully we can learn a little bit from the scriptures as well. In fact, last month, Meredith and I, my wife, we, quote, celebrated the 9th anniversary of a pretty traumatic time in our lives. And regardless of whether you're currently in trauma or currently experiencing adversity, the reality is all of us go through it from time to time, don't we? I'll share one story about when Meredith and I went through that. About 9 years ago, we had our first child. Cassie was born in February. And about 8 weeks later, Cassie had not really grown. She hadn't gained any weight. She had gained about a pound or two. And those of you who or either recently in kind of parenthood or remember that season, know that that's not a good thing when a kid doesn't gain weight. So we, of course, were in and out of the hospital and, you know, or doctors. And as first parents, we're neurotic, right? We're crazy about this. We're bringing them in and we're like, something's not right. And the doctors, of course, are saying, well, it's reflux, right? Because that's what you do. When a kid throws up, they can't consume food, it's reflux. So we were in and out of the doctor's office on 3 or 4 different drugs. Exactly what you want to be putting in your 8-week-old kid, right? So 3 or 4 different drugs, and one particular week, we had been in no less than 3 times. So again, we're feeling like incredibly insecure because we're those crazy parents and the doctors are kind of brushing us off, right? So third or fourth visit into the doctor, and we're about to leave. We're checking out, and Cassie's fingernails are blue. And we didn't put fingernail polish on her. I promise you, there was no fingernail polish. And so Meredith points it out to the doc, and the doc says, well, you know, we should probably get that checked out. So she sends us down to the ER, and sure enough, there was definitely something wrong with her, and it didn't have to do with fingernail polish. They do some x-rays, and docs are huddled around, and, you know, minutes turned into hours, and hours felt like weeks and months. And it was, you can for us as brand new parents. Eventually, one doc came in and sat us down and said to us, there is definitely something wrong with her. The x-rays show a mass that's about 65% of her chest cavity. We don't know what it is, and it could be serious. You need to know that. I told Norton I would do this. Her left lung was collapsed. Her heart was pushed down into the lower quadrant of her chest. Her right lung was about to be collapsing as well. She was literally suffocating. We actually have a picture of Cassie. It's hard to see. Again, regardless of whether you've been in a trying circumstance like that, regarding your health, regarding your finances, regarding your job, regarding relationships, you know the feeling, I think you do, where you wonder, you know, as new parents, we said to the doc, wait a sec, you got to be kidding me. This is our first child. She looks healthy, or kind of healthy. She's our first kid. We've done everything we can. We've fed her. We've bathed her. We've, you know, done everything to maintain her health. This can't be possible. Why her? Why us? Why me? Ask that question. Why do I have to be going through this? Why do we have to be experiencing this kind of trauma? And again, regardless of whether you've experienced adversity like that in health, I believe every single one of us has or will. So this is a message for every single one of us. Regardless of where you are today, all of us will experience adversity like this. I'll spill the beans because, as it turns out, Cassie had a rare lung disease called congenital lobar emphysema, which sounds like a really complicated thing, and I think it probably is. The good news was, the doc said, after further tests and MRIs, the mass in her chest was actually her lung. It was kind of diseased and distended, and it kind of pushed all everything else out of the way. And through a routine surgery, they said, of removing the lung from her chest, she would experience a full recovery. And so we've got another picture of Cass just after surgery. No joke, this is like an hour afterwards. Totally different kid. Her lungs had like recovered, just done some unbelievable things. And now here she is, 9 years old. It's incredible to think about those moments. And the pain, the confusion, the anger, the outright anger that I had at us, maybe for not catching this, at docs, at the world, at God, the outright anger at God. How dare he do something like this? And if you've ever had those thoughts or those emotions, you're not alone. You are not alone. Because every single person in this room has experienced some level of adversity, maybe not to that level, and maybe not to the level of severe joblessness or financial difficulties, but every single person has dealt with it. You are not alone. So again, whether your adversity is now, past, future, whether it's significant or insignificant, you and I, we've all been in the dark room. Where life seems stinky, where life seems claustrophobic, where it's dark, and you oftentimes don't know what to do or where you're going. Well, you may find this hard to believe, but the scriptures have a lot to say about suffering, have a lot to say about difficulty, have a lot to say about adversity. In fact, here's maybe one little known fact. The scriptures talk about adversity being not just optional in life, but actually essential, that this is a part of the life experience. In fact, it's part of the Christian life experience. So if you're here and you're not a God follower, you're not a Christian, the reality is Christians, you need to know, experience just as much, if not more, adversity and more suffering as those who don't necessarily consider God somebody whom they worship. This is a universal experience. We're going to be taking a look at the book of Job. So if you have a Bible, I'd encourage you to turn to it. And if you're kind of new to Bible reading, flip it open right to the middle, and you'll probably be around Psalms or Proverbs or something like that. Hang a left, and you'll find Job just to the left there. Now, the Bible doesn't give a whole lot of answers for why suffering happens. That's the hard part. It's almost like the Bible says, guess what? Stuff happens. Now what? Now what are you going to do with it? Stuff happens. Now what are you going to do with it? In fact, Jesus, in most of his teaching, doesn't address why suffering happens, why adversity happens to you and to me, but rather, what do we do when we suffer? How should we behave when we're in the dark room? And that's what we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about. So we're going to take a look at the first chapter of Job. And Job, just so you know, is a very, very old book. And because it's old and because it's somewhat removed, and frankly, it's not very often kind of looked at in church or outside of church, I wanted to give you guys a little bit of background. Whenever I approach something that is somewhat ancient, I always ask a couple of questions. Who, what, where, when, why, how? So this may be a little tedious, a little academic for a couple of minutes, but humor me. So the who of Job, as we're diving into this. Job, we really don't know who the author is. We know that it's a very old book. It's probably 2,700, roughly, years old, and even that's somewhat speculative. We don't know who the writer was, but we do know why he wrote it, which I'll talk about in just a minute. So he doesn't identify himself, he or she, and he doesn't even really identify who the main character is other than the name Job and the city from which he came. In other words, this isn't a story for a specific people group. This is a story for all times. This is a story and a story for me. So the what? Job is full of both prose and poetry. It's a beautiful book. In fact, many of the books that I've read about Job suggest it's one of the greatest pieces of literature ever written. It's a pretty long book, so I warn you, if you kind of dive into it, you have to wade carefully. It's like poetry. It's one of those things that's difficult to take time and wade through, but the reward is absolutely incredible. Where, what, when? Where, what, when, why? So the where. Job is from a land called Uz, which we'll see in just a minute. We don't know where Uz is. It's kind of placed somewhere in the Middle East, we think, but even that's somewhat speculative. Why was this book written? This is probably the key, because Job, as you know, the patience of Job, we oftentimes refer to, there actually isn't a whole lot of patience in the book of Job. In fact, Job doesn't answer the question, why do bad things happen in the world? Even though it's oftentimes studied for that purpose, the answer that it gives is rather, what do you and I do when we suffer? What do you and I do when we are in the dark room? So let's take a look in the book of Job. Verse 1, in the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man in all the people of the East. Now, what's important to know in this kind of prologue, the introduction to this story, is that ancient Near Eastern authors oftentimes spent a great deal of time developing the character of the story. Now, if you notice, we don't learn a whole lot about Job here. All we know is his name and where he came from. But what does the author spend a lot of time talking about? He's blameless. He's upright. He's rich. He is blessed by God in some profound ways. So that's the key, and is that this isn't a story necessarily about the character Job, but Job's interaction with God and how he interacted with God. Let's continue to verse 4. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. And I don't know about you, but this seems like a little neurotic, kind of like one of those details that you throw in and you're like, I don't really understand why somebody would do something like this. But again, the author's intent is to communicate that Job is what? A righteous man. So he's going to reiterate that time and time and time again. Maybe the most righteous living man right now. So if this were a look at, this is where the story takes a turn. So we've been on earth and we're now moving to some mystical place and we don't know where it is. Job, for the very first time, this gets a little tricky, but we're shifting places. And again, if this was a film, the lights would go down. The sound would go dum 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 dum, and we would obviously kind of shift our focus to some mysterious place in the clouds. Verse 6, one day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. Now, important for us to know in this, if you're kind of new to Bible study, is that writers, just like today, just like I would. I was at a Rockies game just a couple of days. I were trying to communicate to you something, I may say, and Norton, you hit a home run, you know, with that with those announcements. Or Danny, man, that was amazing. Or I struck out, you know, preaching this sermon. That was a total strikeout. Now 2,000 years from now, if somebody were to hear me say that and baseball was no longer around, you think they'd have any idea what I was saying? They'd have to go back and figure out what is struck out, what does hitting a home run mean? And in the same way, the writers used metaphors that were common in their day and age. As you'll see in the next passage, they're portraying God as this kingly figure with a court that's surrounding him, the angels surrounding him. And the Satan, who we see here, is translated both the Satan as well as the adversary. There's an adversary in the court. And again, it's a dramatic tension that's going to unfold for the rest of the story. Verse 7. The Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? The Satan, or the adversary, answered the Lord, from roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it. Again, incredible visual imagery. How many people have seen Lord of the Rings? One of the most incredible epic films. I picture Satan, or the Satan, or the adversary, roaming through the earth, much like Sauron's eye. Do you remember Sauron's eye? Kind of in the second and third verse. I've got a picture of it. Check out Sauron's eye. There's the adversary roaming through the earth. Dramatic, beautiful, terrifying picture of the adversary roaming through the earth, watching, listening, gathering all the info that he, she, or it can to bring back to God. So there's the adversary. Let's see, we are on verse 8. This gets a little tricky here. Verse 8 says, then the Lord said to Satan, or the adversary, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Now, if you're like me, you read something like that and you go, what's God doing challenging the adversary to get out there and do something to this guy who's blameless and upright? And I got to be honest, I've read through that time and time and time again. Now, one thing that you need to know about the book of Job is that scholars call it, it's in the genre called legend. Now, this is opposed to a fable or a tale, meaning it's not totally untrue. But what Job is trying, or the author of Job is trying to communicate, is some historical information, and he's lacing it with some dramatic imagery and some dramatic narrative, creative imagination. So this is one of those passages in order to create the tension that we're about to see unwind. Verse 9, the Satan replied, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you, God, not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You've blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. It seems a little bit disrespectful to kind of talk with God that way, but I got to be honest, I wanted to ask the same question. I mean, is Job's faithfulness due to his riches? Is Job's kind of piety, his pious attitude, the way that he kind of makes sacrifices for his kids to make sure they're pure and blameless and upright, is that because God has given him all this stuff? And so the adversary is basically asking the same question. He's throwing down the gauntlet and saying, God, here's the deal. You take away his prosperity, he's going to curse you to your face. And if you don't, you can't be certain that Job is actually blameless and upright. So again, the tension of the story is set. Verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself, don't lay a finger. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Again, this is the dark side of chapter 1 of Job. Because Job, we presume he's probably at his house, he has four messengers come in a matter of 10 minutes to reveal the worst news maybe a human being has ever been revealed. Sitting in his house, one messenger comes running in, and he's probably panting because he has literally run for his life. The messenger comes in and says, Job, you're not gonna believe this, but these folks came in from the north, and they came down and took all of your animals that I was kind of hanging out with, and all of the servants too. I was the only one to escape. And as that person's sitting there, he's barely been able to finish the sentence, a second messenger comes in. Job, this is terrible. Lightning fell from the sky and struck all of your animals that were out there, and the messengers too, they all died. And I'm the only one who survived. Sentence is barely out of his mouth. A third messenger comes in. Can you see Job? He's like, oh right, what are you going to say? Where's the camera? You know, am I on candid camera? Third messenger comes in and says, Job, you're not going to believe this. Another group of people came in and took all of your camels and all the servants too. A fourth messenger comes in and says, Job, a giant wind came in from the east and knocked down the house where all of your children lived. And not one of them lived. They all died. Four messengers, four bits of news that absolutely wrecked Job's life. So, what news has the messenger brought you? It's terminal. I'm leaving. I can't do this anymore. Here's the pink slip. Or is it an internal messenger? Is it internal news where you're wondering, do I have purpose? I can't figure this thing out. What news did the messenger bring you? Take a look at the next verse. This is Job's reaction to the news. Verse 20. At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. That's, by the way, a traditional style of mourning, to shave your head, tear your tunic, to demonstrate to people that you're in the midst of deep mourning. And then he fell to the ground in worship. Now, before I get too far ahead, or your brain gets too far ahead of me, here's what I'm not going to say. I'm not going to say, you know, you got to buck up and do what Job does. You need to bow down and worship God for the adversity that's in your life. That's not the case at all. In fact, I think there are a couple of things that we can do to be very, very practical to deal with adversity. The very first one is to accept it. We need to accept adversity. Now, that sounds maybe elementary, but the reality is our world tells us to kind of buck up, doesn't it? Our world tells us not to portray to the rest of the world that things are going wrong. And that may be why you and I are lonely. When we feel like we're alone, when we're in the dark room, because the world tells us, hide it, pretend like everything's okay, because we're all shiny, happy people here, right? When deep down, we just need to accept adversity, not just as a cycle of life, though it is that, but as a challenge, as something to move forward to. Number two thing that we need to do is to seek God. Job demonstrates that. And in subsequent weeks, Job wrestles with God in, I think, some beautiful and terrifying and earnest ways. But he seeks God. Now again, if you're somebody who doesn't necessarily seek God, you wouldn't consider yourself a God follower, a church person, or a Christian, I still encourage you, in the midst of adversity, seek God. Pray. Be honest. Be earnest. Tell God what you think. And I guarantee you, He'll meet you where you are. For Christians, the same is true. I'll tell a story next week about when I experienced some pretty significant adversity in my life about 10 years ago, and I turned away from God. I chose not to follow God or seek Him or even accept the adversity that we were in. The third thing, and I think this may be one of the more challenging ones, is to mourn and move on. Job obviously demonstrates tremendous mourning. He shaves his head. What an incredible outward sign of mourning. He doesn't move on immediately. He goes through a 7-day period of mourning and then an even longer period of wrestling with God. We're to accept adversity. We're to seek God, and we are to mourn and move on. Now, just in case, let me read the next couple of passages. This is verse 21 that says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. In other words, Job had the opportunity, like I had the opportunity during Cassie's dark health time when we were in the dark room, I had the opportunity to turn and look in the mirror, just like you and I do, and say, "God, why me? Why us?" Job had the opportunity to turn and look in the mirror and say, "Why me, God? I'm blameless. Don't you see? See all the things that I have done for you and because of you? Why me?" Instead, Job turned and looked out the window and said, "What now? What now?" That window, believe it or not, came from Cassie's room. When we were going through that time, we actually took it out of the house to carry with us. So when you and I are in the dark room, the question to ask is not why me, but what now? I want to tell you about a friend of mine, in closing, who I think has experienced close to a Job story as I've ever seen. His name is Ernest Ruenzi. And he's from Rwanda in East Africa. I had the pleasure and opportunity to go there about 8 years ago. And I've got a picture of Rwanda. If you've never seen it, it may blow your categories. This is not what I expected when I went to Rwanda. It's called Land of a Thousand Hills. It is green and lush and absolutely gorgeous. Next slide is a picture of Ernest Ruenzi on the left and his wife Mart on the right. If you know anything about the history of Rwanda, you know it's a country that is absolutely burdened, oppressed with fighting. In 1994, you may have heard that there was a genocide there. There were two warring tribes, the Hutus and Tutsis. Pastor Ruenzi is a Tutsi, and they were the persecuted tribe. They were in the minority, but they were the ones that were in power. Pastor Ruenzi was one of the people who was persecuted. Anybody and everybody who was in power, had an education, or had a position of authority, they were persecuted and they were killed. Pastor Ruenzi spent a day and a half in a latrine, while over the course of 100 days, nearly 1 million people were slaughtered. He and his wife, Mart, and his 4 kids were separated. They were torn apart. One of his children was killed by a machete. They were separated. Pastor Ruenzi knew that he was in dire, dire territory. So he hid in a latrine for a day and a half. He was eventually found, and he stood on a firing line. I'm not kidding. Stood on a firing line. 2 times he was excused from the firing line because people knew him and said, "I know that guy. He's actually a pretty good guy." Stepped him out. A 3rd time, the gun trigger was actually pulled, and the gun didn't fire. About 100 days later, he returned to his house. It had been burned down. He found his wife and 3 of his children, found out that one of them had been killed in the genocide. Now, can you imagine this man who had dealt, who has dealt with some of the worst trauma, some of the worst adversity, the worst circumstances that you and I can imagine. In fact, most of us would say it's unimaginable what happened. I spared you from some of the pictures that I took. They saved a few of the genocide sites where literally bodies are stored. It is, I mean, the stuff that Pastor Wenzi had to have seen is just unbelievable. Now, here's the deal. Ernest Wenzi had the opportunity to stare in the mirror and say, God, why me? Why, how can you do that? I've dedicated my life to serving you. Why me? Instead, he turned and looked out the window and said, what now? He had started four churches. He's planted four churches. He started an orphanage for children who were orphaned during the genocide. This is a picture of 350 pastors who come in every quarter to be trained because most of the pastors in Burundi, Uganda, Rwanda were eliminated. 350 totally untrained and uneducated people come in every quarter to be trained. And he has spearheaded this entire thing. So if you read the story of like Job and you think, well, gosh, this is totally made up. The reality is it happens. It happens all the time. In fact, it may be happening in some ways here in this room. And the question that you and I have to ask isn't, God, why me? Why? But God, what now? So I encourage each of y'all to accept adversity, to seek God, to mourn, and move on. And not ask the question for long, why me? But to move on and say, Lord, what now? In just a minute, Danny's going to come up and play a song. Let me close this in prayer. Heavenly Father, these are really hard words. It's so much easier to talk about fun, shiny, happy things. It's so much easier to think about life when it's good. And yet, you know, God, that oftentimes life isn't good. Oftentimes life can get downright awful. And so I pray that you would give us courage, God, to accept the circumstances that you've placed us in, to seek you, maybe not despite our circumstances, but because of them, to mourn, God, and to move on, to ask you how you can use those circumstances for our benefit and to your glory. I pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.